Blog Talk Radio.
Everyone, welcome to Stand for Truth Radio Show. So glad that you could join me tonight on Monday, November the 24th. So glad that you're here. We have a very special guest tonight, and we're so lucky to have him on. He is going to be on for the full hour. So if you have any questions, any comments that you want to make on what we're talking about, please give us a call at 347-205-9620, and your number and name will pop up, and I'll put you on hold for momentarily, and then I'll take your call. Our guest tonight has made a number of appearances. I think over the last couple of days, he's been all over the United States making television appearances. He's been on Huckabee. I've seen him on Wall Street Journal Live, and he's been on C-SPAN and probably a number of other things that he can tell you about that he's been on lately. I had first seen him on The Flip Side, and as you might recall, that was a guest I had last week, and that is it's a comedy show with a conservative viewpoint, and I saw my next guest on his show, and I just knew that I wanted to have him on my show. So without further ado, let me bring him on. His name is Daniel Garza, and he is the executive director of Libre Initiative. Daniel, how are you?
Yeah, I'm doing terrific. Thank you so much for the invitation. Can you hear me good?
Oh, I can hear you very well. Yes, just keep a good voice up there, and I'll be able to get on.
great.
You know, one of the things, Daniel, I'm a licensed psychotherapist, and part of what I like to do is I really like to get to know who a person is, and I want the the audience to get to know that person and sort of, you know, where they've come from so that they know why they are where they're at right now and why they do the things that they do. So could you take some time with us and sort of tell us, you know, about your background? I know when I heard a little bit of it before on the flip side, it was very fascinating. So I'm going to turn that over to you to give us a, sort of a background.
Well, sure. Well, let me start by saying that my parents are from a small town near Monterrey, Nuevo León, Mexico. They were born in their homes, and they married, of course, being young, and they looked to the United States as the promised land, where they could really, you know, make a new life and improve the life of their children. They were poor. They went as far as the fourth grade, and so they were farm workers in Central California, and that's where I was born during the grape season. Yeah, and they would migrate from California to the state of Nebraska, hoeing beets in Nebraska, and then to the state of Washington, where they picked apples, pears, peaches, cherries. And they would spend like 3 or 4 months out of the year back in Mexico. And that was the bane of their existence, and that was the bane of my existence till I was at least 14, 15 years old. And then it was sort of during that time when my parents had been saving up money. They were, you know, working real hard, not making much, but what they could set aside, they did. And they took their savings and they risked it in a small business, a small hotel. And in a couple, 2-3 years, they started making money and profit. And then, you know, when we were on our way, you know, we became part of the middle class, and I was able to go off to college. And then a child of farm workers, who was a farm worker myself until I was 18 years of age, if I fast forward now, went to actually become a police officer, a city councilman, working for a congressman, and then a senator, and then the Bush campaign, and then after that was appointed to the Department of the Interior before actually being transferred to the White House to work for George W. Bush as his associate director for the Office of Public Liaison. That was an amazing ride, and I think it's just sort of a reflection of this country that someone, you know, of humble beginnings can work in the most powerful offices in the world.
Absolutely. And how did you get started in all that? I know that your whole public service career, like you said, you worked for a congressman, you were a councilman, appointed to do things by the Bush administration. How does somebody who, you know, comes from the humble beginnings that you did, you know, end up doing it? How did you make those connections in order to be able to do that?
It was a very non-conventional path, I can tell you that. My parents, even though they went as far as the fourth grade, I just considered them very wise, and they were very wise. You know, when I was six, my dad converted and became an evangelical Christian, and it was his constant reading of scripture, of the Bible, that really, I think, and he passed that on to us. My mother and my father were devout Christians who lived a righteous life. You know, as much as they could, of course. I think everybody fails, and of course, you know, in a way, always falls short. But my parents, you know, have been a model to me of a Christian life, and they taught me a lot. And they also taught me that life is sacred, and I am very much pro-life. And that is sort of what had gotten me started in public policy advocacy, because I believe so much in the sanctity of life. And I identified myself as a Republican at an early age, even though I was Latino and I was supposed to be liberal and you know,
right.
I rejected that. I rejected any kind of secularism, anything that veered away from my Christian worldview. And I've always followed that my entire life. I've never checked my faith at the door when it comes to public policy or government. I've always, I think, tried to advance my Christian worldview in everything that I do. And when it came to politics, it was very easy to align as a conservative. And so one thing just led to another, and I think great people that, you know, were put in my path, I think by the favor of God, who opened doors for me, and I was able to you know, just hit that next level, and that next level. To be honest with you, I once heard Condoleezza Rice put it exactly right. She was talking to the graduates of Vanderbilt University, and she said, you know, there are a lot of kids as smart as you are, just as intelligent, just as deserving, cannot be here today because they didn't have that one parent. They didn't have that one teacher. They didn't get the breaks that you got. don't ever forget that when you leave here, that just because you got something, it meant that you deserved it. Or just because you didn't, it meant that you didn't deserve it. And I think that that's it. You know, you have to take your way through life, and you have to make the right decision. I mean, no matter what the barriers are, no matter what the limitations are, this is still a country, like Senator Ted Cruz said, where anybody with nothing can achieve anything.
Mm-hmm. And it's so sad today, because it seems like a lot of what we're seeing in society and sort of what's being, you know, told to us in the government is just the opposite of that. Sort of, you know, become dependent upon the government. You don't have to work for it. We'll help you. We'll just give you what you need, and we'll take care of you, essentially. And that's so opposite of what you did as a child, what your parents instilled into you. How do you change, you know, the young people today, you know, and hearing that, how do you change that philosophy and turn it into something?
We need to have that conversation, to have an honest conversation about what government dependency is doing in as far as taking away the incentives to work hard and punishing those who work hard by overtaxing them, overregulating them, hindering startups and job growth and risk-taking. Look, when I say my parents worked hard. Hard work means hard work. But the thing is, we still have to be a country where we reward hard work, and we need to encourage that. But more and more, it seems like the left, all it does is advocate for more and more programs for more and more people, and we are on an unsustainable path. The worst of it is they kind of incent with government dependency. You know, I think Mark Stein has said it best. When it comes to welfare, it's not so much about the wasted money. It's the wasted lives. And what I mean by that is that when people do, you know, sort of jump on a welfare program and they see it as a way of life, as a lifestyle, you disincentivize hard work and wealth creation and prosperity, you know, where people can hit that next level and achieve their dreams, not the dreams of a politician, but their own dreams. And welfare doesn't provide that for that. And so I think we're advancing policies that induce that kind of dependency, and that's a shame.
It is a shame. And tell me, you know, sort of what the connection is with the Libre Initiative. What is the Libre Initiative, and then what do you do in order to, when you're talking to people going out there, what are you telling them? What is your philosophy that you're putting forth?
So the Libre Initiative was really sort of started because, you know, during my time at the White House, you know, when I had to advocate on behalf of the president to the Latino community and advance his agenda, there weren't a lot of organizations that were out there speaking to the Latino community about the virtues of the free market, about the virtues of a limited government, you know, that kind that Jefferson spoke about, government which governs least, governs best. The kind of organization that was preaching about the virtues of self-reliance and personal responsibility and hard work. And so there was just an absence of this conversation. And what I had noticed was the folks that were dominating the conversation in the Latino communities were the left. The National Council of La Raza, the League of United Latin American Citizens, the unions, Hispanic you know, celebrities, you know, Univision and Telemundo with their tilt towards the left, you know, with the left slant on their news packages when it came to policy. So if the conversation was being dominated by the left, then obviously the kind of information that was reaching the Latino community was not a message that was pro-free market, pro-limited government. And so that's why we launched the Libre Initiative. Was to drive a different conversation within the Latino community about the, you know, really what made America the most prosperous, wealthiest nation and freest nation in the world. And it wasn't more government programs. It wasn't more government handouts. It was freedom in a free nation, you know, who upheld the Constitution, who upheld the Bill of Rights and the Declaration of Independence and honored that. So, you know, we since have launched and now we're 40 full-time staff. We're in 8 states.
Wow, nice.
And about 30 contracted workers, and we are driving this conversation in the media, and like you had mentioned, so we use both mainstream media and Spanish language media to communicate our ideas.
And how receptive are you finding people? I mean, since they've been taught so long.
The reason that we're growing so fast is because Latinos are embracing our message. We have held meetings with really strong convocations. So 700 to 800 people. Sometimes when we work with governors like Rick Perry, Rick Scott, across the nation, you know, we have brought together the Latino community with conservative elected officials so that they can also drive the message and Latinos can understand why they make the decisions that they make, why they preach against the centralization of power in Washington, D.C., and how that impacts state job growth and job creation in the state. So that's been very important, you know, to get, you know, conservative elected leaders in front of the community because they need to hear directly from them. They need to have that kind of access, and it helps to inform their decisions when they make elections. Since we've launched, we've made over 5 million phone calls and visited over 200,000 homes to advance our message about the free markets. Yeah, so we just feel that we need to have a strong grassroots presence across the country in order to mobilize voters towards free market policies and free market candidates. It's been critical.
Do you feel like when you talk to people, do they really understand the Constitution? I mean, it doesn't seem like a lot of people, just in general, don't understand what the Constitution is, what it really stands for, the freedoms that we have because of it, the freedoms that we're looking to lose, you know, when we, you know, so many things are passing today with this administration, and we're losing our constitutional rights one after the other, really, our freedom of speech. And everything else. Do people really grasp that, and do they understand where the Constitution came from and the principles that it's based upon?
Well, I think it's like all social groups across America. There is a general misunderstanding or lack of knowledge about the constitutional principles, Bill of Rights, and the Declaration of Independence. And so part of our challenge is that somehow we need to bridge the gap between those who are very knowledgeable and they have distorted the principles of the Constitution, and then those who have absolutely no idea about the Constitution and could not begin to tell you anything about the Bill of Rights or the Declaration of Independence or what the differences are. So what we try to do is drive really two different kind of conversations in order to bridge that gap. And one is policy. All issues are Latino issues to us. I mean, it's not just immigration. It is education.
Right.
It is foreign policy.
Right.
It is tax reform. We have to talk about all these issues that are coming out of Washington, D.C. And then distill really sort of complicated policy decisions or deliberations that are happening in Washington down to really sort of simple bite-sized nuggets that people can sort of understand, right, can chew on. And we do that through storytelling, through our editorials, through media, and our newsletters. The other kind of conversation that we're having is really a cultural conversation, and that is about the virtues of self-reliance and hard work and personal responsibility and what that means in a society and how you need economic freedom to sustain that and to reward that kind of behavior, to encourage more of that. So, and again, we do that through video production and storytelling and one-on-one. We feel that there is no substitute for one-on-one. That's the best way to communicate. But, you know, obviously this is a media age. And the thing about Latinos right now is that they use a lot of social media. So we're very active on social media. We have almost 100,000 followers on Facebook. And so we drive a conversation through there and then through Twitter as well and some other, you know, platforms that our young kids, you know, obviously engage with. So we don't leave anything out. And we've used both English and Spanish because, again, this is about communicating ideas. But generally, yeah, I mean, it runs the gamut from almost zero knowledge to people who are very knowledgeable, and we need to cater to both of those perspectives.
Yeah, and I'm glad you kind of brought that up. And I was going to ask you, you know, how's it going with the young people and how young do you get them? Because, you know, the really young people, if they're like your typical young people, you know, their whole idea is they've been taught about socialism and you know, just depending upon the government. So how do you change those ideas? I mean, their parents may be more in line with what you're saying, but are you reaching those young people and those, you know, potential voters that are going to be coming down the pike?
Well, here's the thing, you know, and again, the Latino community is very much like the non-Latino community across the country.
Mm-hmm.
there is no one silver bullet that you do.
Right.
There is no one thing that is going to convert people or persuade them or move them over. It is a persistent driving of the message, which is what the left had been doing in the Latino community for so long. So it is going into the churches. It's going into the colleges and universities, the Chamber of Commerce. It's using Spanish and English language media, radio, television, digital, print. It is also using newsletters. It's using social media, Facebook, Twitter. It is being one-on-one by doing local events, whether it's a forum, it's a conference, it's a panel, or a community event where you're tabling and speaking to people one-on-one as they're passing by. So again, it is just a series of things that you just keep doing and you keep hammering. So, for example, in this last election, we had made a deliberate effort to target congressional districts instead of trying to hit the entire map, right? So we targeted District 23 in Texas, District 26 in Florida, and Arizona 2, the Colorado Senate race, and North Carolina, because we felt that if we can target our resources and our messaging, put leaflets on the doors, make the phone call, do the media, both advise and earn media, do editorials, do the mailers. 4 times we sent out mailers. That we just kept driving the message in these districts, you know, and that the Latinos would respond. Well, they did. The Republican won the congressional race in Florida 26. The Republican won in 23, or I should say the more conservative candidate. Which is, of course, you know, our focus. The most conservative candidate won in Arizona 2, and in Colorado Senate, 48% of Latinos voted for Cory Gardner and 48% for Udo, and Tom Tillis in North Carolina. So in every one of the districts that we targeted, we were successful in driving our message, and conservative candidates won out.
And I'm glad that you kind of made that distinction and you said basically, you know, Latinos are like everybody else, basically. And I like that because you can't put people in a certain group and expect them, oh, well, we'll do this and that'll work. But what you've described basically to me sounds like a strategy that could be used across the entire board to bring people over to the conservative side. I don't care who you are. And I really like that approach, and I wish more people would use that approach, because I think, like you said, you just kind of hit all these different areas and you just keep bringing this out and showing people and using every opportunity that you can as a teaching moment. So I think it's a perfect strategy no matter what group you're talking about.
Well, that's exactly right. You're absolutely correct. We feel that there has been an absence of the conversation, and Latinos have not rejected market principles. They just haven't heard them. And so I think the conservative movement and the libertarian movement had just sort of ceded minorities to the left. And the left was driving their agenda, driving the conversation in minority communities. And they were winning.
Mm-hmm.
But now that the tide is turning, now that we're engaging Latinos and the conservative candidates are out there in the communities, in the churches, in the Chamber of Commerce, and they're driving their message, when you engage, you win. And that, you're absolutely right. That is the case with Latinos and non-Latinos. But like I said, for so long, we had ceded minorities to the left, and we were paying a heavy price. So it is high time that I think the conservative movement, you know, did a better job of outreaching to Latinos. Look, the reason that the Libre Initiative focuses so much on the Latino community is because they were being ignored by everybody else.
Right.
Mm-hmm. We are the largest Latino organization that is driving the message into the Hispanic community. And that's a shame, because it only took us 1 year to become the largest conservative Latino organization in the country. That means that there was nobody else doing this. And so, you know, when people ain't hearing the message, freedom doesn't sell itself, like Ronald Reagan said. Freedom, you know, passes on from one generation to the next.
Right.
And so that's our responsibility as conservatives, to make sure that we are passing on the message to all Americans. And so that's really our focus here.
Yeah, because I think, you know, one of the reasons that everything had been with the Latino community on the left is because people just thought, that's the way it is. You know, there's no use for us to try. That's that's just kind of, you know, how Latinos vote. That's what they think, da-da-da-da-da, you know, because we had been trained to believe that's what they think. And it, the people
I
are
I don't
people.
Know where we got that as conservatives, to be honest with you, because a recent Pew poll showed that 33% of Hispanics self-identify as conservatives, 32% self-identify as moderates, and only 30% as liberal. So at any given time, you have 66% of the Hispanic community agreeing with us. So why are we not engaging? Why are we not driving our message, you know, and bringing them on board as activists? We have over 3,000 volunteers that have signed on with us. I'm sorry, almost 5,250 volunteers that have signed on with us. Funds from the Hispanic community for not caring about conservative principles. Indeed, they do, but we just need to, you know, drive the message, and it resonates. It resonates because they care about freedom. They care about, you know, making sure that they become prosperous and they have, you know, a private sector where they are free to start up businesses and there's competition where they can take their skills and their talents to the market.
Right. And what is everybody thinking about that you've come across in the Latino community in regards to the executive order and amnesty that was just
so it's
signed
a mixed
by
bag.
The president?
I think, sure. I think like the rest of America, you know, the majority of Hispanics, I'm going to say, agree with the fact that we need to move away from the status quo because we have a broken system that does not allow us to absorb new immigrants. The 86 Immigration Act absorbed 3 million folks at the time who had, you know, been there unauthorized, but it didn't really accommodate for future flows that met market demand. And so when the president did what he did, you know, a lot of Hispanics were saying, well, finally, you know, that there's some movement now, that somebody has taken some affirmative steps, you know, to try to, you know, move away from the status quo. But most Hispanics do not agree with the way the president did it, which was to impose, you know, his will after showing a remarkable ineptitude and inability to negotiate in good faith with the Republicans to come to an agreement that is has the force of law, that is legislative, that can move people towards legalization or you know, whether it's a path to citizenship or just a work visa. But I think they understand that the president was trying to force the issue. But I think most agree that something had to be done.
And do they realize, though, that, I mean, this is just my opinion and maybe anyone else will agree with me, but do they maybe realize or even consider that the reason he did that is to get voters? I mean, and he doesn't really care so much about them as he does about getting potential Democrat voters down the line.
Oh, goodness, yes. I mean, I think everybody sees through the pandering. And in fact, when the president had made a promise when he first started his administration that he would advance immigration reform in his first 100 days and broke that promise, I think, you know, people were starting to, so you heard the rumbling in the Hispanic community. Then when he didn't pass it in his first 2 years, which he then again promised that he would, people were, you know, had sort of moved from hope to disillusion. So then he made another promise that he would, you know, pass immigration reform in his second term if you reelected him. And then, of course, you know, he failed to do so because they were putting poison pills into the Senate bill and then the House bill. But when he broke that promise on his executive action, I think people were fed up. They were angry. And a lot of Latinos turned away from the Democrats because it turned out that it was the Senate who had asked the president to break his promise on executive action. And in fact, Mary Landrieu, Allison Gundren Grimes, and Kay Hagan from North Carolina were attacking Republicans for their past support of quote-unquote amnesty. So it was like Latinos looking at these Democrat candidates who in the past had made false promises, had broken those promises, now were being antagonistic on immigration reform because it was politically convenient for them to do so. So now that the president has come out and done this, after the election, everybody sees it as pandering, and of course that this is, you know, politics at its lowest level, but a lot of them appreciate the relief that a lot of the undocumented folks are getting right now.
And what is your opinion on, you know, closing the borders, securing the borders, before talking about anything further?
So we want to see a movement towards a sort of a free movement of labor and products, and that means that we need to get on with the business of legalizing the relationship between employers and employees here in America, where we have millions of Americans who hire millions of folks that are here unauthorized, and we have criminalized a very rational activity of someone selling their labor and someone buying their labor. But having said that, we feel very strong, as 75% of Latinos do, that the borders need to be secured. So, you know, while we want to get on with the business of a thriving, growing private sector where we, you know, decriminalize it by absorbing these folks, you know, who are already here, we also need to control our borders much, much better than we're doing, and of course avoid any surges at the border by I think instituting a criteria where the timetables are retroactive, you know, to people who came here before 2010 or something, because otherwise, then, you know, if you were to legalize everybody that has come over, you're gonna create another surge like DACA did when the president passed it. And so we want to avoid that kind of issue. But certainly secure the border, deal with the dreamers, and let the market dictate the number of visas that are coming in for high skilled or low skilled workers in the agricultural sector, especially, and then deal with the 12 million through a work visa program.
And those people that are here illegally, I mean, is there any way, instead of just saying, you know, welcome, and basically giving them all the, you know, what Obama has done, and just giving them worker permits and coming up and all that, I mean, is there some way to charge them a fee, or, you know, get back in line, or, you know, wait for 5 weeks, whatever? I mean, is it's kind of like we always seem to be rewarding criminal activity. And
understood.
And I mean,
contrary to popular belief, actually the Senate bill that was passed and that is waiting for a reconciliation with the House doesn't allow for someone to gain citizenship for 20 years practically.
Right.
So people think that the Senate bill has a fast path to citizenship, and it does not. It is going to take quite a long time. And so I guess the question we have to ask ourselves as American citizens is, will we never give somebody grace or show somebody grace for having violated our immigration law and never allow them to become citizens in their entire life? Or should we say, well, you did violate the law, you shall pay a fine, you shall pay or a penalty, and you are now going to wait your turn in line, and then, you know, we will give you a green card. But during that time, you can never commit a crime. You cannot be on welfare. You can never receive any benefit. And you have to produce. You have to work hard and earn your way to grace. And so I think we should do that. As a country, you know, I think we've always been fair about the way we do things. And some people call it amnesty. Look, I just think that if somebody can prove themselves being a hardworking, industrious person who generates wealth for a country,
I think that's a better approach, because, I mean, you know, if you look at it from a biblical perspective, you know, the approach is, in the Bible, it's about love and the law, which means that you love people and you bring them in and you welcome them and you take care of them, but they also have to be law-abiding, and that means, just like what you said, you give them a way to correct their mistakes, you know, of breaking the law coming here, I guess, and then, you know, get pay for that or wait another amount of time, they have to be working, et cetera, et cetera. And to me, that's a better path than just saying, we're going to reward you for coming in here illegally, and now you can stay, come on in. Because that, we're doing that. We're becoming a United States becoming more lawless every day, and we can't do that. I mean, once you start doing that down that path, it just snowballs. And I, you know, we're kind of going in that direction in a lot of different things. So I understand that.
It is the kind of incentives that we're actually putting up there. You know, do we then reward lawlessness? And the answer is no. I think people have to pay a price. People then have to earn their way back into our good graces. And I think, you know, by putting a longer timetable, I think that is the way to do it. I do feel that at some point we must forgive. We must make amends or allow people to make amends. at 20 years, it's a pretty long time to be proving yourself and remaining crime-free and stuff. So, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say 20 years to me seems like a very long time for somebody to have to wait in order to be able to become a citizen. Because, you know, if I were on out of the country and were not a citizen myself, I mean, I would look at America and want to be here, and I'd want to be able to have an opportunity to come here. So, and I think 20 years waiting would be a very long time to ask anybody to kind of prove themselves. I think maybe 10, maybe a little bit less, you know, would be a little bit more reasonable. So, I mean, not everybody would agree with me on that, but, you know, it's hard to make people wait that long. A lot can happen in 20 years' time.
Well, that's exactly right. I think that there also needs to be a balance as to how much we penalize somebody, how much fee we extract from somebody. Because at the end of the day, of the 11 to 12 million that are here, conservatively, you know, you want as many people participating and as many people out of the shadow contributing to the economy. We know who they are, where they're at, that kind of thing. So, but if you penalize way too much, if you extract too much fees from them, then you're going to have people who cannot afford actually to come out of the shadow. And so we have to be very careful as to how much we penalize somebody too.
Yeah, and I, you know, I just heard today from the Heritage Foundation, they came out and said that the executive order that was signed by President Obama in regards to, you know, amnesty was basically going to cost about $40 billion a year. And, you know, that's a lot of money. And I think, you know, that's another thing that Congress needs to take a look at, and how much this is going to cost and what he did, and how this is going to affect the economy, and whether or not that should be allowed, an executive order should be allowed to stand, or something needs to be done to change that executive order. However, whatever they can do legally to go about changing that, I think that they need to. And again, you know, we have some things where, you know, our government has allowed this to happen by having the borders open. And so we're kind of, you know, we're not doing anything to stop it. And we sort of reward the employers and allow the employers to hire people who are illegal, even though we say we're not going to let them do that. We still let them do that, and we know it's happening. So you can't be looking at it and saying, you know, we don't want this to happen, and then not clean up your own act. And that's what the government has a responsibility as well.
I think you're absolutely right about that. And I think there is a $450 application fee per person who is going who qualifies. And you have to be a parent of a child that was born in the United States to qualify. And I believe half a million students who are going to get extension of their visa also qualify. So at the end of the day, I think they're looking at 4 to 4.5 million who are going to qualify here. It is partial. It doesn't cover the, you know, the 11 or 12 million or so that are here. And that was done purposely, I understand, by the president so that he wouldn't, overextend his executive power. But I think, you know, obviously there's, you know, there are already lawsuits that are going to be filed by, stated by the governor of Texas here, Rick Perry, and the incoming governor, Greg Abbott.
Greg Abbott.
And then I think also, exactly, and then the folks in Kansas and some other states. And I think that's where the lawsuits should happen, at the state level, the states that are impacted by federal policy. That would then, you know, be filed against the president and his executive overreach, you know, that they feel. But I think Republicans in the federal government, and I'm talking about the leadership, John Boehner and McConnell and those guys, I think they have to tread a little bit more lightly and get on with the business of governing. I think they need to pass legislation that is going to, you know, prepare the table for job creation. I think they need to get on with the business of bipartisan effective and market-based immigration reform so that they can supersede this executive action, and I think that would allow them to be seen as leaders who are governing, who are proposing, who are enacting, and moving away from the status quo. And I think that's a more productive, more positive approach to take than getting bogged down in some kind of showdown with the president. I think the governors of the states should take that on.
Yeah, because, you know, the GOP lately hasn't done anything. They've said, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, and they come out and they talk a lot, but they haven't really had a lot of action over the last, I don't know how many years, you know, almost 8 years. And so people are sort of tired of hearing that, and they're tired of seeing them not do anything. It's kind of like they talk the talk, but they don't walk the walk. And we need to move forward. We need to move past the damage that's been done by this administration and like you said, get people back to work and look at what's important. We do need to take care of this issue, but we need to do it in the right way. And it can't be by, you know, closing down the government and doing all kinds of things like that. It's just going to upset people. Although last time I was in favor of closing down the government, if that's what it took. So, you know, I don't know. I'm interested in seeing what they do.
Here's what's interesting, though. In my estimation, I think, you know, moving away from the status quo on immigration reform is good for the country, it's good for our economy, and it's good for the unification of families. But here's now another variable that Republicans have to consider. Latinos shifted dramatically over to them in this last midterm election. And what I mean by that is that in the last election cycle, Democrats had received 73% of the Hispanic vote. This year, it went down 10 points, and it moved towards the Republicans. On top of that, people like Nathan Deal got 42% of the vote. 47% of the Latino vote. Purdue, who was running for Senate in Georgia, got 42%. Abbott got 44%, and in fact, won Latino males in Texas, which is astonishing. And I had mentioned that Gardner had received 48% of the Latino vote, and Brownback and Roberts got over 44% each in Kansas of the Hispanic vote. But here's the kicker: Brian Sandoval got 71% of the overall vote. And he got a massive percentage of the Latino vote above a majority. And for the first time, his coattails delivered because Republicans took power in the Senate and the House in Nevada. And Susana Martinez, her coattails switched power in the state legislature from Democrats in the House because of the Latino vote. So the Latino vote in Nevada and in Colorado also, they flipped the Senate with the Latino vote. So it's critical that they keep that momentum and that favor that is moving over to them, because you're seeing the Latino vote now at the crossroads. And how the GOP proceeds from now on is going to dictate whether they get higher percentages or reverse the positive trend that they saw this midterm election.
Well, I hope you're out there telling them all this, because I'm not sure if they get it, you know. So you may have to go in and talk to them as much as you do the people that you talk to with your initiative, Libre Initiative.
Well, let me tell you, I've seen it across the country. So it's a very positive. Chris Christie got over 52% of the Latino vote. So you are seeing a shift in the political landscape when it comes to the Hispanic vote, which is very positive.
That is so nice. Are you in California at all with your group?
We are in Southern California, mostly a faith-based effort that we're doing in California. But our strength is in Florida, in Texas, in Colorado, Arizona, and Virginia right now. We are going to grow next year into three other states: Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and North Carolina.
Wow. Well, we need you in California here for sure, because
We're preparing the road for California. If we're going to go into California, we're going to go in big, and hopefully by 2016, I think we can begin to expand in a massive way with a big footprint. So, because that's what it's going to take in California. You can't go in with two or three people. We're going to need at least 10 to 15 to 20 people full-time working just in California.
Absolutely, you are, because this is it's so left-leaning, and it has been for so long. I mean, we have Governor Brown for, you know, how many times now, four terms here in California, and he is just, you know, recently he passed another initiative in regards to his own type of amnesty and praised President Obama for what he did. You know, Brown came up with the Dream Act and everything. Do you know anything about the Dream Act? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. No, the Dream Act, of course, is a legislation that would impact the young children who are here unauthorized, but who were brought here by their parents, who were brought here not of their will or their own, you know, they didn't come voluntarily, but, you know, through no fault of their own, and actually do not know anything about their countries of origin. They are American. They were raised in America. They went to American schools. And so for us to say, well, you're not here authorized, you leave, and we're going to deport you and put you in a foreign land, is almost unfair to them. So I think there is general sympathy, you know, across America and both parties, that I think we should treat the children of those who are here unauthorized different than we treat the parents who came here willfully in violation of the law. So Dreamers would address that situation by taking care of the children in a very different way. And frankly, I think, you know, it's like Ronald Reagan had said, you know, with no questions asked, we take care of children. You know, whether it's the fault of the parents or not, you know, we are a nation that takes care of the truly needy. And children, by their very nature, are dependent. And some senior citizens are dependent. And some disabled folks are dependent. And we need to take care of them as a society. So I think that's why they see, you know, kids as entirely different than the rest of the immigrant community.
Yeah. And the children that come here, I mean, they are truly the innocents because they were, you know, they were sent here or brought here. It's not like they had a choice of coming here. I mean, I know even this summer when the ones came over from Central America, you know, you can make an argument, well, they came on their own free will, whatever. But, you know, when you're that young, you don't really know what's going on. You just do what your parents tell you to do and you just go.
Exactly.
And so it's hard to look at them as, you know, they're not criminals. You can't have that criminal intent at that age. You know, for something like that. But what do you feel about, you know, all the illegal immigrants that came here from Central America? What are your thoughts behind how that got started? Who kind of spurred that on?
Oh, you mean the surge itself?
Yes.
Yes, yes. So I live right on the border. I want you to know I live four blocks from Ansaldúa's Bridge in Mission, Texas. I'm talking to you.
Wow.
Four blocks from Ansaldúa's Bridge. And that is the bridge where the surge occurred. And it's still happening. So, I mean, I sort of have firsthand knowledge as to what's going on here. But I can tell you that it was an accumulation or a confluence of factors that drove it. Mainly, it was the president's decision on DACA, the deferred deportation program for the minors, the Dreamers, that basically told that was communicated through Univision and CNN in Espanol and Telemundo across Latin America that the U.S. had made an executive decision to defer deportation of young children. So a lot of parents found out about that and sent their children over to America to see if they could, you know, trigger that qualification. And so there indeed was, I think, as a result of DACA, a surge to the border. But it also had to do with the economic conditions in their homeland. It had to do with, you know, folks who were being, brutalized by gangs, by the drug cartels, and victimized by the slave trade. And you know, the kind of things that, you know, we cannot fathom as, you know, folks who grow up in faces, you know, communities, you know, who go to church and go to work 9 to 5. The kind of things that they have to bear. Now, I know a lot of Americans are saying, well, you know, but that doesn't mean we have to take care of everybody's poor. Well, no, of course not. But it's a reality that is pushing them here. That's the push factor. And the magnet is, of course, a free, prosperous nation. And that dynamic is always going to happen. But, you know, we need to have, obviously, immigration policies that can better deal with that. And I don't think we do. You know, I think our immigration policies right now do not accommodate for you know, one, you know, the demand we have for labor, whether it's low skilled or high skilled, especially in the low skilled areas. I can tell you from personal experience, having grown up a farm worker, I worked in the fields until I was 18 years of age, and just about I picked just about everything under the sun. I cannot count on one hand the number of non-Latinos that I saw in the field.
Right.
I cannot count for you on one hand the number of non-Latinos that I saw in the field. So a lot of the folks who are here unauthorized are farm workers who are doing backbreaking hard work under the elements, and we need them. We need it, but right now we've created a sort of an illegal kind of, you know, industry where our immigration laws does not allow us to accommodate, you know, for that kind of work, you know, or labor that we really do need. And so, you know, just on that alone, I think we need to fix our immigration system.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think, you know, what makes people so angry is when something is sort of set up by the administration or seemingly so, and all these people rush over and, you know, here we have, again, the open borders and people just, you know, flood on in. And then it's kind of like, okay, now that they're here, we have to take care of them. And even go a step further, we're going to let them all go, you know, and oh, but don't worry, they're going to come back, you know, and they're going to come back when it's time for them to have their hearing. And I think people just don't like what appears to be, you know, lying, being lied to. And it's one thing if you say, well, they're here, we're just going to have to do this, and, you know, we're probably half of them or more than half won't even come back, but, you know, that's just the way it is. People can take that more.
That is an absolutely legitimate concern that all Americans have, you know, that they see the border and they sense a loss of control, our resources are overwhelmed, that our, you know, the people on the border who are, you know, paid to protect us and to guard the borders cannot deal
right.
with the flow. You're absolutely right. But the status quo doesn't allow us to take care of that. It is inadequate. And so we need to marshal more resources to the border. Our border is long. I mean, it is.
Yeah.
If you actually straighten it out, it runs from the point from the tip of Texas all the way to Chicago. That's a long border, and it requires
a
lot of
border.
Resources. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So we need legislation that is going to, you know, again, sort of allocate better resources, whether that's virtual walls, real walls, whether that's ATVs, helicopters, radars, more staff. More training, whatever it is, we need to pass legislation that is going to, you know, I think help us fund the kind of adequate resources we need on the border. And then, of course, I think simultaneously we can move on the other pieces that can help us to address the situation we have now across the country with the folks that are here.
Yeah, and I think people just, you know, they see that as, you know, with putting everybody from Central America, putting them on buses and sending them to different cities and states around the United States, and people were getting overwhelmed, and the school systems right now, especially like in California, they're just overwhelmed with people from Central America, and they really don't have the resources to take care of them, and yet here we are, and money is going out, and yes, you can seek reimbursement from the federal government, but good luck in getting that, and is that really, once you get that money back, is it, you know, you're bound money someplace else? In California, just keeps giving more and more and more. And sooner or later, you know, everybody out there kind of jokes on Twitter, like, we're just waiting for California to go bankrupt.
Here's the thing. That is probably primarily more a fault of the entitlement system that we've created here. It is not so much the immigrants who come, because then, of course, they're educated and informed about these kind of services. And then, they access them. But I think that's more of our own welfare, you know, system that we created that is at fault here. I would say that America's history is a history where we absorbed waves and waves of poor immigrants. But our economic system allowed those waves and waves of poor immigrants to generate wealth, their new wealth, you know, to work hard, to be industrious, to populate, you know, the corners of our country and create, you know, massive cities that were thriving and prosperous. So I don't fear waves of poor immigrants. What I actually fear is a government that would hinder or suppress our economic freedom, our free market system, and render it almost incapable of absorbing, you know, new waves of poor immigrants. That would put them on entitlement programs, that would put them on these kind of benefits. So I don't think that's so much, you know, the fault of immigrants. That's our own fault, you know, for creating that kind of, you know.
Absolutely. But I think part of, you know, what they do is the United States does that too, because they, you know, it's political correctness. They don't want to be seen as racist. I mean, if you don't give everybody everything these days, you're racist, you know, and it's like, no, we just don't have the money. And I think that, it's just the way the government, it's going towards socialism, and that's the way it is. And that's what happens when you go towards socialism. You have to give everybody everything, and that's how you keep it going. And that's not what the American public wants. And, you know, again, go ahead.
Notions of redistribution of earned wealth, you know, where you take from
somebody's
hard-earned money to redistribute it to somebody else. And that is a failure of liberalism.
Absolutely.
We should be focusing on redistribution of knowledge and opportunity. That is
absolutely.
You know, we of course we take care of children, of course we take care of the disabled and some senior citizens who are dependent. But, you know, able-bodied people, let us focus on creating jobs and economic opportunities for them. That should be our focus as a society, and that's how you lift people up and empower them. Not giving this cheap alternative of dependency or, you know, government programs. You do more to stifle and hinder the dignity of an individual and wealth creation than anything else, and that is the wrong path. And that is the kind of honest conversation we're going to be driving out there with Hispanic Americans.
No, that's excellent. And do you have any videos out there that people could watch on YouTube or elsewhere that your message at the Libre Initiative that people could see?
Yes, absolutely. They could visit, of course, YouTube and put the Libre Initiative, and you know, tons of videos will pop up. Or you can put My American Experience, Daniel Garza, and then you can start seeing some of the kind of storytelling that we're putting out there. And you know, because at the end of the day, it's like you started the program by saying, I want to get to know you and who you are. I think once people can relate to you on a personal level, then you can communicate ideas much more effective and better, because at least they know who you are personally and what you're about. So they need to know that my intention is good and that our policies are better. And once they believe that, then we can have an honest conversation, and then we can begin to share ideas as to how we can make, you know, America stronger and more prosperous.
And I think it's also a really good thing to let people know that we all have a lot in common. We're not just one group over here, one group over here, one group over here.
Amen.
We have a lot in common, and we need to start bringing that out more and bringing people together instead of pushing people apart. And I think, you know, this administration has done a lot of that and putting roadblocks in between people and groups, and it has to stop. We're all on the same side.
I tell you, another failure of liberalism is that they do not believe in people. They do not believe that people have the required skills and the vast capacity to be self-reliant, to pick themselves up and to achieve their dreams by working hard and bringing their skills to market. Conservatives do. We believe in the individual. The individual matters, you know, and the kind
Absolutely.
Of skills and our vast capacities matter. And that's what we bring to market, and that's how we'll prosper and thrive and achieve, you know, our aspirations and our dreams. Our aspirations and our dreams, not the politician, not
right.
some central planner in Washington, D.C., but our very own. And so until we believe that, until we believe in our own power, and you know, God Almighty, I think we're going to have issues for a long time to come.
Yeah, I do too. And, you know, I think I'm so glad that you were able to come on tonight and spend the whole hour with us, because I think that people got a good idea of who you are and what you really stand for and where you're going. And I know I'm going to be making up my Daniel Garza for president posters tonight, because I think you need to run for president.
I'm blushing right now.
You have the right ideas. You really do. And please, for God's sakes, you know, go and get the message to Congress and let them know what they need to do, because you're certainly on the right track. And again, thank you so much for being here.
Well, you're saying it.
Well, you're welcome. And if you know, when you come to California, I'm here in California, let me know how I can help you, and I mean that. Because I believe in
Thank
what
you
you're
so
doing,
much.
And I want to get the word out. So anything I can do to help you.
I appreciate that very much. And absolutely, we're committed to driving the message. And of course, I, you know, render my services to you as well anytime. So
thank you
for having me on.
Thank you so much. And I'm going to let you go. You have a great Thanksgiving. God bless you.
God bless. Bye.
Thanks. Well, there you have it. What an excellent, excellent guest. He certainly has the right ideas. I hope he is able to get that message out to Congress and to anybody and everybody who will listen. He certainly has the right idea. So that will do it for us for another edition of Stand for Truth. I wish everybody out there great and happy Thanksgiving. And until next time, stand for truth. Take care.